Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is the Thread Book Hour. Twice a month, I'll bring you some of my favorite interviews with authors, Tracy Mumford's Ask a Bookseller, and some must-read book picks. A bit later, writer Paul Auster on creating a novel about parallel lives.
I've been pondering this question of what if all my life, of course. I think most of us do. One day, an idea came to me, which was to tell the story of a person's life as a set of parallel lives and to play out the different options.
But we begin with Molly Brodick. Her memoir about her father opens with the list of banks he robbed the summer she was 13, nearly a dozen, including the bank in which she would one day open her first checking account. Her father would go to prison twice for bank robbery, and Molly would grow up slowly understanding, as she confides, being a good, hardworking dad and a criminal at the same time is a way of choosing neither. Molly Brodick is a poet and a writer. Her memoir is titled Bandit, and she joins us today from Atlanta. Molly, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have to say that that word criminal is, well, it's jarring in that sentence that I read. And maybe it's the juxtaposition of hardworking dad and the idea of criminal. Do you think your father ever accepted that description of himself?
No, I don't think so. I think he would have seen himself as someone who, you know, cut some corners to make his life work.
That circumstances kind of forced him into the decisions that he made. And do you think he believed that even after he'd been to prison twice?
It's really hard to say what he believes. I've tried to talk to him about it. I gave him a chance to open up to me through our correspondence, and it still remains pretty unclear the way he sees it. He did admit to me in some of his letters that he feels that he made mistakes, but it's really unclear how sincere he was, considering that his whole life he operated in a kind of con man type way of being, even with his closest family. So it's kind of unclear.
That's what's so odd about this, that there was a performance aspect to the way he was in the world, and he never it sounds like he never really dropped that.
Right. He never dropped that with his children, with his wife. No one could have been closer to him than us, and it did always feel like a performance. There's a scene in the book where I describe going to visit him in prison, and he still has the act on, even in prison. I describe it almost like, you know, we go in and we see him, and you just kind of imagine that your father's going to appear contrite or maybe embarrassed of visiting with his daughter in prison. But instead, he acts completely calm and collected, and he's sort of leaning back on his chair and acting as if we're visiting him in his summer home.
I think this is why, you know, most little girls hero worship their fathers. I did. You want to. I think it's part of growing up. And yet, from the very beginning, I think you describe yourself as a non-believer, right? You know there's something not solid about your father.
You know, our parents are the first way as children that we understand what it means to be a person. And we get so much information from them about how to grow up and how to be, how to act, how to think, how to talk. And there was always this element of falseness with him that even though I didn't understand a lot of times as a young girl, I could feel it. I could just feel that there was something fake about him. And I think when you spend that much time around someone who's a con man, you sort of get a little better at detecting when people are real or not. So I sort of grew up with a real deep suspicion, you know, and I don't think that was healthy, and I don't think he intended that, but that's one of the legacies of his parenting.
Would it be right if I said that you've carried that that sense of can I really trust what I think I know into your adult life and into other relationships? Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think in some ways it made me a very inquisitive person. I never accepted sort of surface realities in some way, and that helped me as a poet and helped me as a writer to constantly be questioning things. On the other hand, it's very exhausting, and it does interfere with personal relationships as well. And that's something that I've had to work on.
Yeah, I think just from having understood you a little better through the memoir, that your father knew that you saw through him. And that's a really uncomfortable thing for people, you know, other people in your life with whom you're interacting too. Just this sense of, what you're showing me is not what I believe, no matter how honest you think you're being.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because I hope that he knew. I hope that he knew. And I see other people sort of reading that in the memoir. And I guess I still feel pretty inconclusive about what he thought about me. But so, for example, my sister, I have one sister and she's older, and she was always very emotionally involved with him and felt powerless over him. And she sort of was always being manipulated by him and taken advantage of by him. Whereas me, being the younger sister, I think I kind of observed that and kept my distance and didn't get too involved with his sort of manipulative, methods. And I'm not totally sure if he knew that I could see that, or if he just thought, I just didn't love him, or what he thought. You know, it's really hard to know someone's internal state, but
that is really interesting, yeah. Molly, that I and some of the others are reading this memoir as he knew you didn't buy his act. And that's why it sounds like he treated you quite different. I mean, you had the sense, didn't you, growing up, that he didn't really like you very much.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. He just didn't have the same power over me that he had over my sister. And so a lot of times he would just kind of, leave me be, which I wanted, because I saw how distressed she was as a child, constantly working to try to please him in all these impossible ways. So I kept my distance. And lucky for me, I also lived with my mom. My parents were split, so I didn't have to see him all the time like she did. I think he also was to some extent disengaged with me. And probably the reason why I can engage with him now and why I can write this memoir, whereas it's still too sensitive for my sister to try to approach it as an adult now.
You mean to approach,
approach him and to, and to think about and to articulate sort of what happened to her. She just sort of shuts it out of her memory. She doesn't talk to him. She doesn't like thinking about him. So because I had that distance, I think I feel safer in approaching him and writing about him.
Do you think some of this with your sister is because she bought the con, even though I know there were moments when she would realize, she accepted that he robbed banks and that he had lied to her about it, but in so many ways, emotionally, she kind of bought the con. Do you think that's embarrassing?
Yeah, she did buy the con, and, probably of no fault of her own. She was a child, and she was, for the most part, alone with him. She would come to stay with my mother and I sometimes, but she had no choice. I mean, that was her parent. That was her only role model. But, that's got to be hard for her now as an adult to look back and probably regret, the way that she interacted with him, and all of the years of her life that she gave up to him in worry and distress that, you know, now I can say she's incredibly happy being totally disentangled from him. She's just a much happier, free person. So she just doesn't want to go there.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is The Thread, and I'm having a conversation with Molly Brodack about her memoir, Bandit, a daughter's memoir. So your father started robbing banks because he was gambling a lot, right? And he had gambling debts piling up.
Right. He robbed 10 banks over the course of one summer in 1993. And, you know, yeah, he had gambling debts. He owed money to probably some unsavory characters who were after him and probably threatening his life, maybe threatening his family's life. But, you know, the choice to rob banks to commit a crime instead of asking anybody that he knew for help, that's a sort of mind-boggling choice for the average person to consider. Why did he go to that, you know, place instead of going to the sort of normal place we would all, go first, to ask a brother or sister or a friend to help us out? He sort of went to this extreme just right off the bat, and it's really hard to understand that.
Do you think some of that is because he would have had to drop the con? I mean, part of the con was, I'm living this life, and I'm living large, and this is who I am, and I'm pulling it all together. Wouldn't he have had to admit none of that was true, and he was in over his head, and he was really in trouble?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, a lot of people want to know why. Why did he commit the crimes? Why would he make this completely irrational choice to rob banks and continue robbing them? And for me, you know, usually at the heart of irrational choices is emotion. And I think my father was incredibly proud, and it would have been just too hard for him to ask for help. It just wasn't even any kind of coping mechanism on his radar to ask for help or to have to humble himself before a family member, especially. So, I think that it was definitely, an attempt to keep the con going.
Will you describe, because you have actual details about what he did when he would go into these banks to rob them, will you just give us an example of how he would pull this off? Because he usually wasn't brandishing a weapon, was he?
Right. In fact, he didn't have a gun the first time he robbed banks. He would simply walk into a branch and, you know, take his finger and point it through his jacket pocket as if to look like the muzzle of a gun, tell the teller that he had a gun by writing her a note and passing it through the window and sort of demanding all of her money. And then he would just sort of receive the money and calmly walk out. So all of the people around him didn't even know there was a robbery going on. And this is why I think he managed to achieve 10 banks, rather than getting caught right away. He sort of took on this very calm and calculated procedure rather than making like a big show of it.
I mean, did you get the sense that he was so casual about this, that did you get the sense that he knew this just couldn't last? Mm. And that I guess maybe he thought, well, I'll get what I need and I'll stop and no one will ever know the difference. And it'll be something that I can kind of forget that I did to pull myself out of trouble. What do you think?
I have to say, yeah, I think he did think, oh, I'll just make this money and then, yeah, I'll stop and it'll be okay. Although I have to say, when they caught him and the FBI was going through his belongings, they found in his room a fake ID that he was trying to make for himself. He had a photo and an X-Acto knife and some fake names printed up on tiny paper as if he was in the act of trying to put together a fake ID. Does that mean he was trying to think of an escape plan and possibly had on his mind that he was just going to run away from my sister, run away from all of his obligations and try to start over? I don't know. I don't know what the fake ID was for, but it's hard to imagine that he would have wanted to run away. I think he did like his cover. I think he liked, you know, appearing to be the sort of normal man and father. So I don't know. I will say the second time he robbed banks, so he went to prison, he served his time, he got out. He lived a pretty normal life for about 6 or 7 years. And as addicts do, he got into gambling trouble again. He decided to rob another bank again. And this time, I feel deep down that he probably wanted to go back to prison. Yeah. I think that he knew he was going to get caught. And I can't help but feel like maybe subconsciously he felt safer in prison and he wanted to go back.
What would it mean to your perception of him if it's true that he was creating a plan to go away, to escape? Would it change what you think of him?
I think so, in the sense that, you know, he never really abandoned my sister or I. He was always around. He would still kind of show up and take us to the movies and be a parent sort of part-time. But the decision to completely abandon us, that would definitely change my opinion of him. And so, that's a big question mark in my mind.
When you decided you were going to tell this story of your father, did you also know immediately you were going to have to come clean about your own stealing and how successful you were as a thief?
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I felt like it would be fair, you know. I felt like that should be what I should do. That was hard to do. I shoplifted for, you know, a year or two when I was in college, and I was good at it, and I could really get away with it, and I made some money doing it.
Why were you good at it?
Well, you know, looking back, I think I did learn some of the lessons about what my dad did. Sort of, I think I did take them in subconsciously. So, for example, I knew that when you go to shoplift, you have to pretend first and foremost that you're not a shoplifter. You know, you have to go in and just like be a regular woman shopping. And so the first lie you tell is to yourself. And I think that that was at the heart of how my dad operated. So I took that on.
You know, you also have to kind of have what I think of as nerves of steel. You have to
right.
be one of those people who can compartmentalize your anxiety, your fear. A lot of people can't do that.
Oh, absolutely. You shouldn't be able to do that if you're healthy. You should be terrified of being caught when you're shoplifting. But you put on this, I mean, it's the same skill that actors use where you just empty out yourself and you become this other person. And so, yeah, it's a little bit scary to be able to do that. It's a little bit sociopathic, and I write about that in the book.
You also write in this passage that really struck me about how you didn't think of your father when you were stealing. And I just want to read a graph here if I could. I didn't think about my dad at the time, but I do now. I'm saying this because I know what it's like to make the wrong choice over and over, as if taunting the consequences, practically asking them to come straighten you up. What's the last part of that mean? Taunting the consequences and asking them to come straighten you up. What does that mean?
Well, you know, like I said, I think that my father suffered from his gambling addiction. And I think that in the world, when he was free, he just couldn't control his impulses. And I do think that robbing a bank may have been a way to, you know, ask for help in this really disordered way and to sort of save him from his, you know, web of addiction and depression that he must have been in. So I think that that was part of part of the reason why he did it. I don't think he would admit to that. I don't think he would consciously say that. But deep down, you know, when you act out like that or you commit a kind of a showy crime like bank robbery, you know, I can't help but it's a little self-destructive in the sense that you're probably looking for a way out of the cycle that you're in.
That's such a good point, because there's a lot of fraud that you could probably undertake in a very quiet way to get money that isn't, as you've just said, the kind of showy crime that robbing a bank is.
Yeah.
I've never really thought about it that way.
Yeah, he had so many other options. It's just a mind-boggling choice. And so I can't help but think, like, you know, it must have been deep down a kind of a cry for help.
You know that knowing that you shoplifted is somewhat of a mind-boggling choice, too. Those of us on the outside reading your story, that you would run those risks and make that kind of moral choice, given what you knew you thought about your dad? How well do you understand this now about yourself?
Well, I try. I work to understand it, you know. I think no one is perfect at understanding themselves in some ways, but I do think that it was important for me to write about my shoplifting sprees and to admit that as a way to try to understand it. So I'm proud of myself for being able to do that, because I was embarrassed to write about it, and it was hard for me to think about that going out into the world. But it helped me a lot. And, you know, I do see the similarities with my father, and I'm aware of that. And I also think that, it wasn't as bad as it could have been, in the sense that I didn't take up an addiction. You know, I didn't let myself completely implode like another person could have in my position.
Yeah, you're lucky, aren't you?
Yeah.
Because what if that is the way that you bought the drugs that you need? You know, I mean, we can go down the list, right? You were not, in the end, captive to the kind of addiction that your father was there, but for the grace, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I am curious about this. Did your parents know about the shoplifting before the memoir came out?
No, nobody knew about it.
No, not even your sister?
Not my sister. Not even the partner that I was living with at the time. I hid it from everyone. So it was a complete shock. And when my mom read the rough draft of the manuscript, she was shocked, and she said, "Does this really have to be in here?" She was worried for me. But like I said, I felt like, okay, I have to do this. This seems fair. If I'm going to write about my father's secrets, I should put this in about myself, because I want people to know that, you know, this isn't my dad's a bad guy and I'm a good guy. This is about humanity, and it's complicated, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. You've used that word fair a few times, and it's kind of, I guess I hear it a little bit of as an acknowledgement that you've told your story, but you've also told his, and you know that there's a certain license that you're taking in doing that. And so if you're going to do that, you'd better tell your whole story, right?
Right?
I mean, that's where I hear the trade-off. Is that it?
That is it. And also, I had to keep focused on the idea that although my dad is an enormously interesting part of my life, this is still a memoir. You know, it's still about what it was like for me. And so I had to reveal myself, as every memoirist does. I had to make myself vulnerable. And I signed up for that, you know, in writing about this. So I was willing to go there.
You know, it sounds like that you have always been an adventurous reader, and you found books as an escape at a pretty young age. But I was intrigued to read that you stopped reading about families for a really long time. And I thought, oh my gosh, she missed so much great fiction.
Yeah.
Because of that. How long did that go on?
Through high school and the early part of college, I eventually came back to novels, and I've caught up to some extent. But yeah, I avoided novels. I avoided novels completely because, you know, novels are mostly about relationships and a lot of times about family. They're about the ways that people interact. And so I just was so annoyed with that whole genre of writing because I wanted to feel maybe disconnected from my connections because I didn't feel like they were healthy. But also there was something about the fiction genre, the idea that these writers were sitting down and making up people and making up stories. And that struck me as just so dishonest in those years. You know, I don't know why. I think I felt like extremely interested in and maybe defensive of things I perceived to be true. And I was really interested in trying to find out as much as I could about the world. And that didn't involve, you know, reading fake stories, you know, that you could read in novels about fake people. So I was just, you know, really suspicious of that for a long time.
Yeah, it's funny because you know that fiction can tell truth in a way that nonfiction, journalism, writing sometimes can't. Or maybe it can be more, people are perhaps more receptive to the truths that fiction can tell than they are to the kind of journalism that tells truth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I see that now. You know, I think, you know, it says a lot that novels are probably the most widely read of any literary art form. People crave truth, and they find it in novels. And the best writers know how to tell the truth, you know, through these made-up characters and made-up scenarios. So, yeah, I've come around.
Is there a memoir that's been especially important to you?
Well, you know, I read on recommendation The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. And because as I started to write this, someone said, well, this is also a woman who had to write a really hard story down, a really dark, hard family story. And so maybe you'll get some courage from reading this. And of course, her story is really different. But it inspired me to just sort of be able to do it. I was so frozen when I first started to write down the story of my life because I was thinking about other people reading it. It just paralyzed me.
But of course you would think that.
Right. So I had to sit down, and as I was writing the memoir, I just sort of told myself that this was just for me and that no one on the planet would read this. And that was the only way I could get it out. So, yeah, it took some courage, and I was inspired by that.
Molly, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Molly Brodack's memoir is called Bandit, A Daughter's Memoir. I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to The Thread Book Hour on NPR News Presents, insightful interviews with writers and must-read book recommendations. Tracy Mumford is here with me to talk about people who love books and sell books and what they're reading, and you call it Ask a Bookseller. What's the deal with it?
That's right. So, I mean, booksellers always give the best book recommendations.
They do.
They're surrounded by books all day. They love books, and they always know what's coming up.
They do.
So we've been running this Ask a Bookseller series where every week we check in with a bookseller in a different state to find out what they're excited about, what's big there. And for this one, I talked to Jody Smits, who is a bookseller at the Page and Palette in Fairhope, Alabama. And she is really excited about this historical novel called The Other Einstein.
Because it's an astonishing account of the first wife of Albert Einstein. Her name is Mileva Marek. and it is about the possibility of her contributing work on the accounts of relativity. And it also gives us an insight as to what her marriage with him was all about. He was not always the most favorite husband, but she loved him dearly and supported him completely with everything that he was doing. She believed in it. But she also had a sense of what it meant to live in that time and not be appreciated for her work solely based on the fact that she was a woman. The book itself brought everything into perspective as to what relativity is all about and what it can mean to each human being in respect to motion, events, time, place, and that if any iota of that changes, then it can change the outcome of something.
So that was Jodi Smith. She's recommending The Other Einstein, which is this historical novel, like she said, all about Einstein's first wife, who isn't someone I know anything.
Know nothing about
nothing
that.
About.
I'm going to read that novel
exactly.
Now.
So like I said, this is something I'm doing every week, and I'm trying to talk to booksellers in all the states, and I'm hoping to hit all 50 by the end of July.
Are you finding that there is any geographical, you know, alignment with what they're reading?
Well, it's always fun when booksellers are excited about a local author. So I do get authors that I've never heard of who are big in Michigan or big in Louisiana. So it is fun to see what's big where.
Trace, thanks.
Thank you.
Tracy Mumford writes for The Thread. You can check it out at nprnews.org/thread. You're listening to The Thread Book Hour on NPR News Presents. I'm Carrie Miller. Now to Ewan Kerr's revealing interview with writer Paul Auster. At 70 years old, Auster's been thinking about the roads he's traveled and the ones he didn't. And even though the story is not autobiographical, Auster is asking a question many of us ask about our lives. What if?
Paul Auster, thanks for joining us today. I'd like to begin by asking you, where did the stories, this gathering of stories for your novel 4321 come from in the first place?
I've been pondering this question of what if all my life, of course. I think most of us do. But one day, as happens with all the books I've ever written, one day an idea came to me, which was to tell the story of a person's life as a set of parallel lives, and to play out the different options. And I was so compelled by this idea, so excited by it, that I launched into writing this enormous book. And I knew it would be enormous just because of the multiple stories. So in effect, it's like four novels, or at least three and a third novels, all in one volume.
So tell me a little about Archie Ferguson himself. Who is he, or who are he, I suppose, might be the right word.
That's a wonderful sentence, who are he? Archie is the son of Rose Adler and Stanley Ferguson. He's born in 1947 in a hospital in Newark, New Jersey. His parents are both second-generation Jews in America. Archie grows up basically in the suburbs around Newark. The four Fergusons live in four different towns. That's the first divergence. And as time goes on, more and more things begin to diverge. He's genetically the same person, but his circumstances are often vastly different from one to the other. And therefore, he develops in different ways, even though all four boys share certain traits. I think essentially that's the book. It's a book about human development, to my mind. What it feels like to be a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old. All these different stages we go through. And when I first thought about the book, I thought I would take them much deeper into their lives. But then as I began to understand better what I was doing, I realized that early adulthood was about as far as I wanted to go, because then they would become more settled and the nature of the story would have changed. And I was interested in how how they kept mutating into these different versions of themselves as they advanced through time.
You certainly put Archie through the ringer, though. He has a very, very interesting life in the Chinese curse sense of a way.
Well, it's true, but he lives in, as they say in that Chinese proverb, interesting times. And we're talking about the 50s, but particularly the 60s, as he's really coming of age. And it was so tumultuous. It's my era. I mean, the book is not autobiographical. I only took a few minor things from my own life. But the geography is my geography, and the chronology is my chronology. And just remembering those days of 50 years ago, how fractured this country was, how divided it was. And so many of the things we were living through then seemed to be present on the American scene now. And how little things have changed, and yet how much at the same time. It's bewildering, to tell the truth.
We're talking with Paul Auster about his new novel, 4321. This is a portrait of a young man, but as you said, it is also a portrait of a difficult time or an interesting time. And as I was thinking back, I saw traces about literature, creativity, the publishing industry, the whole thing about what's been going on with American education. I mean, there is so much packed into this. How did you go about keeping yourself sane as you tried to keep it all straight?
I don't know. I've been at this so long, you understand. I have been writing for more than 50 years, and by now these things are just part of my body. I know what I'm doing, just without having to think about it too consciously. It's inside the blood and the bones and the head and the hand, and it's all coming out onto the page. But it really wasn't difficult. The difficulty was taking things out. There were so many more things I wanted to talk about, but I realized that I had to keep it as streamlined as possible. So as I've said, I know the book is an elephant, but I hope it's a sprinting elephant. And because each chapter is more or less a work unto itself. It's the length of a long short story or a short novella. And so I would start out with each chapter with 50 things I wanted to write about. And in the end, I wrote about 7 of them.
Do you give people advice on how to read this book?
I would say read it from the first sentence to the last sentence in order. Some people have said, well, wouldn't it be interesting to jump around, read cycle 1 and then cycle 2, 3, and 4 separately? And I think no. I think the pleasure of the book, if there is pleasure in it, and I hope there is in the whirl, in the swirl of these overlapping cycles. And I think that's the way the book should be read.
There is a moment, and I don't want to give away anything, obviously, but one of the stories ends early. And I have to admit, reading it, every time I came to that thread going forward, there was a pang of extreme sadness, which was I've never really felt with a book before. I mean, it was just palpable. Am I unusual in
no,
this?
No, not at all. I've heard this from many people. I think we can say what it is. One of the boys, number 2, dies at the age of 13 in an accident. But as the cycles go on, each time we get to number 2, there's a blank page with the number of the chapter. And I really wanted it to be like a knife in the heart of the reader, because I love that boy, Archie, too. He was, in a way, the brightest and the best of all of them. And it was very hard for me to write the passage, I can tell you. But then you keep seeing that blank page each time his story should be told. And I think it's the the use of typography, literally, to tell the story, or the lack of a story.
Which I suppose brings up an issue, though, or an idea, though. As you wrote this, did you prefer markedly one Archie over the others?
No.
Or did you rank them, or how did
no,
that go?
But they're different. I mean, even though they share certain things, like, for example, they're all interested in sports. They all gravitate toward writing in one form or another, be it journalism or criticism or fiction. But they're all involved with writing, and they all love music, and they like to play baseball and basketball. So they share those things. But I would say the temperaments of the boys are different. Number one, who becomes the journalist, I think has a kind of melancholic temperament. He's an inward, somewhat lacking in confidence. Number two, the one who doesn't live long, is very plucky. And he's a boy who, if he had lived, would have, I think, succeeded greatly in the world. Number three suffers the terrible experience of losing his father when he's 7 years old. And so this Ferguson, number three, is much more confused, much more fractious, gets into much more trouble than any of the other Fergusons. But at the same time, I find him deeply lovable, but confused. Number four, the one who becomes the fiction writer, is angry. He has tremendous conflicts with his father. That's the version of the family in which the parents get divorced. And he's a bit of a Puritan. He's a hard-nosed, ambitious person, perceived as cold by many people. So they are different. And but that doesn't mean I don't feel an equal affection for all of them. You have to love your characters when you're writing a novel. Otherwise, you can't get inside them.
You also have other characters who come through several of the stories. Girlfriends, obviously, parents, mm-hmm. other relatives, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. certain friends, friends of parents. And I suppose I have to ask, were they all the same, or are they also changed by fate?
They changed because, for example, Ferguson's Aunt Mildred, who is an intellectual and becomes a professor, but in each one of the four versions, she is teaching at a different place. She's either married or not married. She's either, you know, with this person or that person. So her story is different. Then there's the female counterpart to Archie, who is Amy Schneiderman. Amy, especially Amy in the first version, Amy the girlfriend, is a passionate girl, full of intelligence and ideas. And she becomes very politically active in the 60s, very involved in the anti-war movement, for example. She's a student at Barnard when she goes to college. And Ferguson One, the journalist, is at Columbia. And there's a lot about the events of 1968 at Columbia. And well, without getting into too much detail about it, they don't see eye to eye ultimately on the political issues of the moment. Amy, in the step cousin version, is an important figure, but a little less important than she is in the first version. The thing is that all the Fergusons love Amy, but ultimately she's unattainable. It just never works out. The one who becomes her stepbrother, Ferguson IV, is pining for her, but she's not interested. She just wants to be friends. But Amy, I think, is certainly the second most important character in the book.
There is so much in this book. Did you have to do a lot of research to go back and touch on all the important details?
I did research, particularly about dates. I wanted to know exactly when everything happened. For example, everyone knows about the march from Selma to Montgomery. Everyone knows what happened on Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And I mention it, but what people forget is that the very next day after Bloody Sunday was the day that the U.S. Marines invaded Vietnam. These two things were going on in parallel and simultaneously, the civil rights movement and the growing war in Vietnam. And those were the two burning issues of the day, and they both divided the country in terrible ways.
You mentioned earlier that you see a certain reflection of today in the events that you describe. And of course, in the time since you finished this book, we've seen some pretty tumultuous change in the country as a result of the election. Does this make the book even more relevant, do you think?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps. It was surprising to me as I was delving into these matters from half a century ago, how relevant they still seem. To tell you the truth, the first title I had in mind for the book was Ferguson. But about a year and a half into the writing of the book, this terrible event happened in a place, Ferguson, Missouri, which very few of us knew even existed. And now that name is going to be as important as Selma, I think, in the story of race relations in America. So I couldn't use that title. Everyone who saw the cover of the book would have thought I was writing about that. So I came up with the alternative 4321. So even that, so the present affected my book about the past, which is finally very interesting.
How has writing this novel changed you, do you think, as a writer?
Well, I've never attempted anything this big. I'm not saying it's the most ambitious book of my life, but it's certainly the largest. And just the mere fact of writing something on this scale, it was at once very invigorating. I was lit up during the years I was writing this book. I couldn't stop. It was an obsession. I'd get up early, I'd go down in my little room and just work all day, and then I would be so exhausted, both physically and mentally, that I could barely do anything in the evenings except lie on the sofa and watch baseball games or old movies and just recuperate. And then I'd get a night's sleep and back I'd be the next day. I didn't do any readings. I didn't do any interviews. I didn't travel. You know, all the things writers tend to do, I didn't. And just stuck with the book. And because the strange thing was, I started writing it when I was 66. And 66 was the year my father died. And my father was a healthy man who just dropped dead. And everyone assumed he would live to 90. He was in perfect health. He never drank. He never smoked. And so I had this eerie sensation of passing through this boundary. And the day came when I got to be older than my father ever got to be. And so I kept thinking I was going to die, that some lightning bolt would strike me down. And I wanted to finish the book, and which I thought would take me 5 or 6 years. But I did it in a much more concentrated time, and I think because of that, I mean, it's a strange confession to make, but for a while there, I was haunted by the idea that my days were numbered.
Well, it seems that a lot of the book really is about mortality. It's hanging over all the stories.
Yes, for sure. And I think the central emotional core of the book, and I think the reason why I wrote it, is connected to something that happened to me. And I've written about this, so this is not, you know, a revelation. But when I was 14 years old, I was at a summer camp in New York State, and there were about 20 boys who went out on a hike in the woods, and I was one of those boys. We got caught in a tremendous electric storm with spears of lightning darting down around us, thunder booming, torrential rains, and the general consensus was that we should get to a clearing and get away from the trees. And we found a meadow, and we had to, in order to get there to the meadow, we had to crawl under a barbed wire fence, and we went single file. And the boy directly in front of me was halfway through the wire when lightning struck it, and he was electrocuted on the spot. And this event, I think, is truly the most important thing that ever happened to me. And the revelation that anything can happen at any moment to anyone, that you can be breathing and fully alive one instant and then dead the next. And this has haunted me all my life. And this incident is at the core of the book. It's not what the book is the only thing it's about, but it's the emotional center for me, in any case.
Boy, I can understand that.
Yeah, well, it was a strange time. 14 is such a vulnerable age. You're still very much in the process of becoming who you are. You don't even know who you are fully at 14. And, you know, I had grown up thinking the world was a pretty stable place. And then suddenly I understood that it wasn't. And it opened up a whole new world of thinking for me.
Writer Paul Auster with NPR's You in Care. I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to The Thread Book Hour on NPR News Presents. Tracy and I are going to leave you with two favorite must-read books, but you can find a whole lot more at the Thread page at nprnews.org. You can also get my weekly book essay in your inbox by texting the word book to 677-677. Okay, Tracy, I know you've been traveling. You probably read on the flight.
I did.
Did what you read blow your mind, or are you talking about another book today?
No, I'm really excited about this book. It's called Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. It is set in Japanese-occupied Korea pre-World War II. Not a time that I know a whole lot about, not a place that I've read a lot of these multi-generational family sagas from, and I just loved it. The writing is beautiful, and there's this great relationship between mother and son that I found so fascinating. Pachinko, absolutely recommend.
Okay, this totally wasn't planned, but the book that I love is a series of short stories by Leslie Amnika Arima. She's a Minneapolis-based author. I've never heard, I think this is her debut collection of short stories.
It is.
And it's just a series of meditations and stories about that dynamic between daughters and fathers. There are some mothers in here, but she's really exploring what it is sometimes to be raised by a dad when your mother isn't in your life, or what it is to lose a father early on and how that shapes and influences the rest of your life. The dialogue is really sassy. She takes us in some of these stories back to Nigeria. And I cannot wait to talk to her about this short story collection. So it's called What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. And yours is?
Pachinko by Min Jin Lee.
All right. And two of our must-reads, you can find a whole lot more on the Thread page, nprnews.org/thread. And that's the Thread Book Hour.